This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
An explosion rocks Beirut. The governor calls it their Nagasaki, their Hiroshima. I'm Marco Werman, the latest from Beirut today on the show. Also today, the U.S. faces the highest case numbers and death count from the coronavirus on the planet. Why is America getting this so wrong?
It's in some ways truly unbelievable that a country with our wealth, with our scientific capacity, could be botching this pandemic as badly as we are.
Also, hot spots in the Amazon and a dry forecast have scientists on edge.
I can only imagine the fires are going to be much worse this year than they were last year.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. This afternoon in Beirut, a massive explosion at the city's port. A billowing pillar of white smoke was followed by what looked like a huge mushroom cloud and a fireball. Buildings dozens of blocks away were damaged. There are casualties, but it's too early to know exactly how many. Also, reports of hospitals at capacity with coronavirus patients turning away people injured from the blast. The governor of the region of Beirut, Marwan Aboud, told Sky News Arabia that this disaster looked like scenes from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Then he broke down. Journalist Fatima El Mahmoud lives just a few minutes from the port and felt her apartment shake before hearing the explosion.
My very first instinct upon hearing the explosion was, oh God, another war. We do not have the time. We're already struggling financially, economically, you know, with the coronavirus now, and everything's a mess. So I'm like, seriously, like now, how much more can this country handle? How much more can we handle?
Lizzie Porter is also a journalist in Beirut.
This was a loud rumble, thunder-like rumble, and it started shaking the buildings, and then it carried on, and it really, really felt like an earthquake was happening. I've had an experience of an earthquake once in the past, and it felt very, very similar. Then there was a huge bang. I was blasted backwards, and my glasses fell off. I sort of staggered around for a few moments and got up. Everything was covered with glass because all of our windows have been blasted away. And I ran down our stairs outside and tried to take cover because I thought it might happen again. If this was an explosion, then it might happen again. There are sirens all around us now, helicopters flying overhead. There are really, really enormous scenes of destruction in Beirut here tonight.
In miles, how far is your apartment from the port, the site of the blast?
So we're about 1.5 kilometers, so around
a mile. Yeah.
The fact that there are almost no windows left in our neighborhood really gives you a sense of the enormity of this blast. And the fact that this was huge. I also had a couple of friends who are in the mountains, about 15, 20 kilometers outside of Beirut, and they said that they felt the blast up there. They didn't have windows smashed, but they felt the ripples of the blast.
The initial casualty reports are not good. The numbers are changing rapidly. Have you tried to get in touch with hospitals, and what have you heard from first responders?
Hospitals are overwhelmed at the moment. There are reports of one hospital alone treating 500 people, images of bloodied patients going in to receive emergency treatment. Both myself and my flatmate have things that we think probably need stitches, but we're staying away because we're well aware that the hospitals are going to be overwhelmed. The Lebanese Red Cross, which is responsible for lots of the first response here in Beirut and wider Lebanon, has said that there are still going to be people trapped in depots at the port, in buildings that were damaged and destroyed by the blast. So the emergency services are going to be kept extremely busy, unfortunately, I fear tonight.
I can hear the sirens still blaring in the background.
Absolutely.
I'm reluctant to ask about this, but what do we know about the cause of the explosion? Because at first officials said there were fireworks involved. I mean, how much reliable information is there right now?
There are several theories put about. Immediately, people think it's an Israeli missile on Hezbollah. We do know here, people in Lebanon do know that Israel strikes Syrian Hezbollah weapons depots in Syria. So it's not too much of a stretch of the imagination for people to think, oh, well, they've struck them in Lebanon now. People are already scared about the prospect of another war because of the economic situation. And people believe that another war is about to happen between Hezbollah and Israel. There is no confirmation of that.
Right. We should say that Israeli officials have officially denied any involvement, and so has Hezbollah. There were also some reports of a second explosion. Do you have any details on that?
I don't at the moment. From what I can see and what I heard is that it was one extremely loud bang and that there is still smoke rising from sites and clearly fires will have been ignited as a result of the huge initial blast.
That's journalist Lizzie Porter in Beirut today. We'll have more coverage tomorrow here on The World. American exceptionalism, it's been a way to describe the uniqueness and shared purpose of the American experiment, the scale of U.S. power and influence, too big to fail. COVID-19, though, has redefined American exceptionalism, and not in a proud way. Today, this is American exceptionalism. The U.S. has the highest number of COVID deaths in the world, the highest number of total cases in the world, and those continue to rise in both urban and rural areas. So let's look at where the U.S. fits into the global coronavirus picture. Joining us is Dr. Ashish Jha. He's the director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. These trends in rising cases and deaths here in the United States are staggering. Give us a reality check. Where do these numbers put us in relation to the rest of the globe?
It really is impressive just how poorly America is doing. By almost every measure, we are the worst performing nation, certainly worst performing high income country. And our performance is far, far worse than most low and middle income countries. It's in some ways truly unbelievable that a country with our wealth, with our scientific capacity, could be botching this pandemic as badly as we are.
So if we look at the seven countries with the most COVID cases in the world, six are middle-income countries, Brazil, India, Russia, for example, not lower-income countries. The U.S. still thinks of itself as upper-income, but if you look at the U.S. partners in infection rates, I mean, what does that say about the U.S. response and where the U.S. sits in relation to the world, specifically in terms of health infrastructure?
There's no question that money is not the primary reason why some countries are doing better than others. There are plenty of low-income countries. Vietnam is often heralded, but others as well, who've just done a fabulous job with few resources because the public health response to this pandemic does not require a lot of money. What it requires is taking the virus seriously, doing basic public health measures, and not becoming excessively susceptible to misinformation. And on all of those fronts, America has failed quite badly, whereas countries that are middle and high and low income across the world have done much better.
So 6 months in, you look at places like Hong Kong, China, Singapore, Vietnam, and South Korea. They responded hard. They responded fast, but it's not like the pandemic has gone away there. We've been reporting on a spike in infections in Vietnam. Cases are much lower compared to here, but what lessons do you see in the flare-ups we've been seeing in places that do have this under better control?
If you're a Vietnam or you're a South Korea or a Germany, these flare-ups are like little brush fires. And they kind of pop up and you can put them down. America is in the middle of kind of a raging forest fire. It's a totally different landscape of what we are dealing with. I expect that every country, even the most successful, will continue to have outbreaks, and they have infrastructure and strategy for managing that.
So what are we learning about what's working and what is not working in other countries, and what it is that the U.S. appears not to be doing?
Yeah, so what's interesting is if you look at various success stories, take a New Zealand, a South Korea, and a Germany, three pretty successful approaches, they all look a little different from each other, right? So there isn't like there is one model that everybody else followed and we didn't. So in some places, it was about really vigorous lockdowns. Other places, it was aggressive testing and tracing. In places like Germany, it was kind of a mixture of all of those things. And all of those strategies have largely worked in keeping virus under control, their hospitals from getting
full. Do you know this last line? How's this drawing inspiration from one part of
again,
life these days?
I keep coming back
what is
to
that alluding to?
And the amount of misinformation spread by Facebook in our country is massive. And then where we really become different than everybody else is that our political leaders have amplified it and at times appears that they've even come to believe it and acted on it. And that really is different. You don't see Angela Merkel promoting goofy ideas that no scientist believes.
Coming up, Ana Tijoux from Chile talks about creating music during the pandemic.
Is the failure of the political class to be able to differentiate noise.
How that network rallied behind her latest single.
Still ahead,
who's seen President Trump's interview with Jonathan Swan of Axios.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem to have a grip on the data.
Well, right here, the United States is lowest in numerous categories.
Okay,
and we're lower than
I guess I'm
world,
only going to hear that in
lower,
my
lower than what,
phone.
Europe?
In what? In what?
Can't. Take a look. Right here. Here's case death.
Oh, you're doing death as a proportion of cases.
Coming up, Ana Tijoux from Chile talks about
that's
creating music
really
during
bad.
The pandemic.
Well, much worse than South Korea, Germany,
okay.
etc.
You can't do that. You have
why
to
go
to
our real leadership, as we've seen,
oh,
as you've explained in other countries,
right,
interprets the data according to science, and they create policy accordingly. How concerned are you by Trump's leadership through COVID? I mean, if you take the Axios interview, it doesn't appear to be in touch with reality. Coming up on The World, Ana Tijoux from Chile talks about creating music during the pandemic.
That our political leaders have seen this as a political campaign as opposed to a scientific campaign, and therefore have tried to find statistics and data.
How that network rallied behind her latest single, that's still ahead here on The World.
Scientific data that actually guides us on how to move forward. Very little that has come out of the president has been science-driven. You know, what's been interesting is that he put together a task force led by Dr. Fauci and Dr. Burke that actually has given us real, credible scientific answers of how to do this. And then the president goes out and undermines his own scientists. It's a very baffling situation that clearly has made the U.S. federal response arguably among the worst in the world.
Clearly, the U.S. is in a dire situation. As a public health expert, what steps do you want to see taken next?
We have the tools and we have the know-how for bringing this virus under control. If every state passed a public mask law and enforced it, so people had to wear masks when they were out and about, if we closed indoor gatherings, so closed bars, closed gyms, I believe that closing indoor dining is probably necessary in most of the states, if not all. If we really limited gatherings of people indoors in any context to a small number for short periods of time. And then we fixed our testing infrastructure, which continues to be really problematic. We could do all of that. None of that would require kind of a Manhattan Project kind of, you know, man on the moon thing. We have the technology. If we did all of that, we could get the virus under control. We could get our kids back to school. We could open up more workplaces. We could get through this without tens of thousands of more Americans dying. But it doesn't seem to me like as a nation we have an appetite for doing those things.
Dr. Ashish Jha, the head of the Harvard Global Health Institute. In September, he becomes the dean of Brown University's School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're approaching the height of wildfire season in Brazil's Amazon rainforest. Already, July's fires this year were more severe than last year's, and last year's fires were alarming. The World's Carolyn Beeler reports on the outlook for the Amazon.
The Amazon rainforest is so big, the best way to measure fires there is with satellites orbiting far above Earth. And the images captured in July show a worrying trend compared to data from the same period last year.
We have seen an increase, about 28% of active fires in the Amazon.
Anya Alencar is the director of science at the Amazon Environmental Research Institute.
And this is something that we expected in a way.
They expected it because fires follow a predictable pattern in the Amazon. People clear forests to plant crops or graze cattle or dig a mine and then burn the felled trees. In the past year, an area at least the size of Connecticut has been cleared, the most in at least a decade.
Which means that there is a lot of areas that are ready to burn, which means we have the perfect recipe for a lot of fires, maybe more fires than what we had last year.
Last year, the fires in the Brazilian Amazon triggered a diplomatic crisis for President Jair Bolsonaro. He's rolled back the country's once strict environmental regulations in his push to develop the Amazon, and deforestation has spiked under his watch. The Amazon stores a massive amount of carbon, equivalent to about a decade's worth of global emissions at current rates. So, when it burns, much of the world pays attention. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson brought up the issue ahead of last year's G7 summit.
One of the things I'm going to be raising at the G7 is the horrific loss of habitats and species around the world.
Even Pope Francis weighed in on the fires, calling them a new form of colonialism.
Dio ci preservi dall'avidità dei nuovi colonialismi.
But despite all this attention, last year didn't end up being a record-breaking fire season. Carlos Perez is a conservation ecologist at the University of East Anglia in the UK.
The thing is that last year the fires were particularly alarming, but it was not a very dry year.
Perez says rains last year helped keep lots of the man-made fires from spreading out of control. This year, we might not be so lucky.
It looks like it's going to be a drier year this year than it was last year. And if you combine that with the current political scenario in Brazil, then you basically have the perfect storm.
Perez's research has shown that indigenous lands in the Amazon have historically been better protected from deforestation than other parts of the rainforest. But he worries that as COVID-19 strikes these communities hard, protecting their land may be even more difficult this year.
So I can only imagine the fires are going to be much worse this year than they were last year.
There are signs that Bolsonaro is starting to take the Amazon fires more seriously. In May, he launched a military mission to protect the region, and last month issued a 4-month burn ban. But Sully Araújo, the former head of Brazil's environment agency, says banning something that's already largely illegal makes little sense.
The decree, it has no effect. It's only a speech.
Instead, Araújo says Brazil needs more environmental protection agents. It needs to enforce fines for environmental crimes and stop cutting the environment agency's budget. But really, she says, Bolsonaro needs to stop talking about the Amazon mostly as a resource to be exploited.
In my opinion, the worst thing is this discourse. The worst reason is the president's speech. This is very hard to deal with.
But this isn't the only difficult issue Brazil must deal with as the coronavirus pandemic continues to tear through the country. For The World, I'm Carolyn Buehler.
When King Juan Carlos I took the Spanish throne in 1975, he brought with him the hopes of a return to democracy. Remember, this was after nearly 4 decades of dictatorship under Generalissimo Francisco Franco. But the king's reign was riddled with scandals. Yesterday, the former king disappeared into exile. Reporter Jennifer Omani has been following the story and joins us from Madrid. Jennifer, where is Juan Carlos?
So, Marco, this is really the million-dollar question. Before leaving Spain, Juan Carlos wrote a letter to his son explaining his personal life was getting in the way of his public persona, but he didn't say where he was going, and it's really not clear where he is. Some Spanish media are reporting that he's now in Dominican Republic, and others say he's back in Portugal, where he spent his childhood. But actually, Spain's Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, came out today and said he doesn't even know where he is.
So take us back, if you would, to how Juan Carlos came to the throne in the first place in the 70s.
Well, I'd love to just give his full name, which is Juan Carlos Alfonso Víctor María de Borbón y Borbón. Juan Carlos was, he's been a controversial figure long before this incident, some would say for his entire life. For a long time, Spanish people admired Juan Carlos because instead of taking over as an absolute ruler, he backed a transition to democracy once Franco was gone. In 1981, there was a coup attempt against this new democracy, this new vision of Spain. He appeared on television.
La corona, símbolo de la permanencia y unidad de la patria.
He said the crown couldn't tolerate actions which interrupted by force this new democratic constitution voted for by Spanish people in a referendum. So he put down that military coup, backed democracy, and won fans across the political spectrum in Spain.
So when did he start to get associated with scandal?
Well, his luster began to wane in 2012. He went on an elephant hunting trip in Botswana and managed to injure himself pretty badly as well, causing an international incident. He posed with a dead elephant, and once this picture started circulating globally, Spanish people really felt that he just was out of touch. He's currently being investigated by Spanish and Swiss prosecutors as the beneficiary of offshore accounts linked to the Saudi Arabian government. And the final straw here seems to have been the announcement that the Spanish Supreme Court was launching an investigation into this deal, and separately leaked audio of his mistress talking about him. He's also supposed to have gifted this mistress 65 million euros, which is also under scrutiny.
Mm. Exile is such a, I don't know, reminds me of Napoleon. So this comes during a kind of complicated time for Spain politically. The king is off in exile. What's going on with the government right now?
I think the wound could be really mortal for the royal family in Spain if Juan Carlos's son is found to be involved. Felipe VI is desperately distancing himself from his father, renouncing his inheritance from Juan Carlos, and he's cut off his own father's stipend, actually. But if it is found that he's had any closer connection to some of his father's dealings, Spanish people are really not in the mood to hear about that. Spain is suffering terribly from the fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, and unemployment levels are very, very high. The government is also split, so you have the much more establishment socialist party, which is not keen to investigate the royal household, doesn't see it as its place, while they're much more left-wing, far-left coalition partners, Podemos, they want a republic and they want Juan Carlos on trial.
Reporter Jennifer Omani in Madrid, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Coming up on The World, Ana Tijoux from Chile talks about creating music during the pandemic.
Even if you are a solo artist, you always compose with your friends, your friend that is a pianist or a guitarist. It's a social network. It's not a solo network.
How that network rallied behind her latest single, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of WGBH and PRX. The question on every parent's mind right now, will schools reopen? When? And if not, then what happens? These questions are also top of mind for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
We face a generational catastrophe that would waste untold human potential, undermine decades of progress, and exacerbate entrenched inequalities.
Guterres also said today that more than 1 billion children in some 160 countries will be missing school this year, exacerbating what he called an ongoing learning crisis. Joining me is Emiliana Vega. She's the co-director of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution. Emiliana, as you look at the impact that coronavirus is having on schooling and education, what strikes you? What worries you the most?
You know, the main concern really is the learning loss that they are experiencing already, and the likelihood that these impacts will be very different depending on where the child is, the resources that they have access to in their communities and their homes.
And for these disadvantaged communities, what are you already seeing when it comes to education?
Well, we're seeing that they are being hard hit. We also know from previous pandemics, like the Ebola crisis in Africa, for example, that girls suffered more than boys in terms of abuse at home, in terms of pregnancy rates, dropping out of school as a consequence of being out of school for so long. And there are reports that that's happening again in various parts of the world, including Africa and Latin America, with teenage pregnancy rates rising. We know there's refugee crisis from Venezuela and throughout, you know, the world, but in particular in South America. And those are populations that are being hardest hit.
How does the equation change from, say, first graders to, like, juniors in high school, for example?
Well, what we've seen from the countries that have reopened already, in Europe in particular, and in some of the East Asian countries, is that there is an effort to bring back the younger kids first for two reasons. One is they're less likely to be able to sit through hours and hours of device work, but also because they require more parental guidance and support, and sometimes that's not available to them. In terms of the older students, really there, the inequality of both the quality of the remote education that they can access as well as access to internet and devices makes a huge difference in what they can continue to do while the schools are closed. And we also know that they also have a special time in their kind of development trajectory where socialization and interacting with other peers is very important. And so that's another worry, is not just the academic loss, but the development losses in other areas and socio-emotional development.
If only it were the case that everyone at all socioeconomic classes had access to devices for learning. What are we losing, though, by having a strictly online learning experience, assuming that that could be the case for all students in the world?
Well, I think the evidence is very clear that online learning is not a substitute for in-person instruction. Where it works best is when it complements the work of excellent teachers. So there are ways in which, you know, in rural areas, in remote areas where you don't have qualified teachers in all subjects, having pre-recorded lessons of a really excellent teacher can help expand quality education. But all of this, to be successful, really needs to have well-trained, thoughtful educators guiding the student in the use of technology.
Emiliana Vegas, the co-director of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Right in the center of Paris, there is a migrant camp for young boys. This morning, it was cleared out by the police. This comes after a weeks-long campaign by NGOs calling on the French government to provide housing for the kids who had been living in tents. The boys all claim to be under the age of 18 and have been moved to temporary housing in a nearby gymnasium. As Rebecca Rossman reports, their future remains uncertain.
It took only 2 hours to dismantle the camp just steps away from the Place de la République in central Paris. But before that, some 100 boys spent 6 weeks living in the makeshift shelter set up by a small group of NGOs. Most of them are undocumented migrants from West Africa. Gondika Bakari is one of them. He tells me he's 16, going on 17. Before arriving at the camp, Bakari spent 8 months living in the streets, even during the coronavirus lockdown in March. He says the camp was an improvement and his new temporary shelter at a nearby gym is even better. But there's still a higher risk of contracting the virus in cramped quarters. He says when he talks to his mom on the phone, he lies and says he's living with a family.
Every time I call her, she asks me how I'm doing, and I say I'm fine. But I can't tell her the truth, that I'm sleeping outside, that it's noisy. I just can't tell her that.
Bakari, who is originally from Mali, says what he really wants is to be allowed to go to school. But until the state agrees that he's a minor, he'll have to keep living in this sort of limbo. He has to prove he's under 18, but the French government often can't verify documents from abroad. And there's another wrinkle. If the youth turn 18 during their waiting time, they are then treated as adults.
I don't understand such situation.
Corinne Tour is the head of mission at the Paris chapter of Doctors Without Borders.
Clearly, the country of the human rights, we are not respecting this, clearly. That's the point.
Doctors Without Borders is one of the 5 NGOs negotiating with the French government to find a permanent shelter for the boys. All the boys involved have had their initial request to be treated as minors rejected by the state. Tor says many of these judgments are based entirely on a 30-minute interview. So the boys are appealing their cases.
They are waiting for a judgment to confirm if they are minors or not. So during that time, they should be protected, which is not the case.
Instead, the government has put the responsibility on the NGOs, who say they don't have the means to provide the necessary care. Tor estimates there are around 20,000 unaccompanied minors living on the streets in France. They're invisible, she says.
It's why we decided to put them in the tents to be visible.
Even with the new temporary housing, the boys are still waiting for a permanent solution. The NGOs are asking for a state-funded permanent shelter just for minors as they go through the appeals process. Catherine Delano Daoud is a lawyer specializing in children's rights. She reckons the majority of the appeals will be successful.
In the end, more than half of the children who have gone through this process in front of the judge for children will be recognized as underage.
But in the interim, by international law, France has an obligation to protect the migrants. Just like presumption of innocence, they have the right to be presumed as children, she says.
And that is where, for the time being, France does not comply with its obligations and the international standards and conventions it has signed.
The main one being the International Convention on the Rights of the Child, signed by 140 countries. The French government didn't respond to requests for an interview for this story. At a recent demonstration in front of the Palais Royal near the Louvre in Paris, activists gather to call for a solution. Gondiga Bakari is here with friends. They're dancing in the heat, holding up signs, and grooving to a favorite protest song by a famous Cote d'Ivoirian singer.
Ça me plaît trop, c'est très important pour nous.
Bakari says he's feeling good today, but his mom still doesn't know about his living situation. The next time she calls, he plans to tell her he's safe. This time, he hopes it will be the truth. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
A year or so ago, who among us had heard of TikTok? All right, don't raise your hand if you're under 21. TikTok is now the fastest growing app on the market. Very recently, though, it's been at the center of a Cold War-style battle between the U.S. and China. Microsoft wants to buy the video sharing app from the Chinese company that owns it. President Trump said yesterday that the U.S. Treasury would need to get a chunk of the sale price for U.S. regulators to approve the deal. Adam Siegel has been watching all this closely. He directs the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Hey, Adam.
How you doing?
Okay, I just want to start with what President Trump said yesterday.
So it'll close down on September 15th unless Microsoft or somebody else is able to buy it and work out a deal, an appropriate deal, so the Treasury of the – really the Treasury, I guess you would say, of the United States gets a lot of money. A lot of money.
What do you make of that?
That's really hard to figure out what the president means, since there doesn't seem to be any legal mechanism or precedent for the U.S. being paid for a merger and acquisition. It undermines the argument that we're doing this for national security reasons.
Trump wasn't clear on whether that money should come from Microsoft if it purchased TikTok or TikTok's Chinese parent company ByteDance. Is it even legal?
I have seen people with a better legal basis in this field than I do say it seems to be unconstitutional. But as was with many things with President Trump, it seems to be without precedent. So who really knows?
All right, let's just put that slice aside because it is one gobsmacking part of a larger picture. What is the big picture of what's going on here with TikTok? How has it gotten caught in the middle of what looks like a Cold War battle between the U.S. and China?
Yeah, I mean, I think it arrived on the radar screen of China hawks in the Trump administration because it became the first global platform with tens of millions of users, and they became worried about what access to data that gave the Chinese government and what it said about the rise of China as a tech competitor.
Is the U.S. right to feel threatened by Chinese technology?
I think there are legitimate threats. I'm not sure that TikTok represents one. I mean, we've seen a similar debate about the Chinese telecom manufacturer Huawei and its rise as a provider for 5G networks. I think the security threat there is more legitimate. It's not clear to me what the national security threat is of the data of 15-year-olds making funny videos. We do know that Chinese, through hacking and other sources, have already access to a lot of citizens' data. So I don't see a huge security threat there.
Are there other threats that TikTok could represent to the White House?
There seems to be two other concerns. One is kind of influence operations and propaganda. And because the algorithm that recommends TikToks is unknown to most users, there's a worry that it could be exploited and promote either disinformation or stories that are supportive of the Chinese government's view. And then some have suggested that because TikTok has a number of people, including Sarah Cooper and others.
I was just going to ask you about Sarah Cooper.
Who make fun of the president very effectively, that he is out to get the platform for that way. It may be a concern, but there's a real possibility of a backlash there. I mean, young conservatives also use the platform. And so there does seem to be some reaction from TikTok users who are supporters of the president who don't support the ban.
Adam Siegel, he directs the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks very much for being with us, Adam.
My pleasure.
In 2014, an international treaty to prevent violence against women went into effect. It's called the Istanbul Convention, and most countries in Europe have adopted it. They agreed to create special legal categories for gender-based violence, but now some signatories are having second thoughts. The government in Poland has indicated it will quit the treaty. Turkey is now considering a similar move. So Turkish women are worried of a spike in domestic violence and other crimes against women there. From Istanbul, Duri Biskaran reports.
When everything shuts down, where do you go when you can't go home? This is a question that haunts Elif Ege. When the coronavirus pandemic hit Turkey, a government-run network of domestic violence shelters, legal aid groups, and other support pretty much ground to a halt.
They didn't have any kind of hotline. So when you shut down all of these mechanisms, when you cannot apply in person, as it happened during the pandemic, they became useless.
Ege says hundreds of women called her organization, a privately run women's foundation called Morchata. But even it, too, had to close its shelter to prevent the spread of coronavirus.
Our shelter is like a small environment. This would put other women in danger.
It's not that the lockdowns necessarily made violence rates go up, Ege says. It's that women in abusive situations had fewer ways to get out of danger. And this is precisely the scenario that the Istanbul Convention is designed to prevent. Ege says that's why withdrawing from the treaty would be a mistake.
It will mean that we won't be able to get any good judicial decisions that protect women, that shows perpetrators that if you ever practice violence, you are going to be punished for this.
That's Numan Kurtulmuş speaking in July. He's deputy chairman of Turkey's ruling party. Kurtulmuş says that the Istanbul Convention would be reviewed and that Turkey may withdraw from the agreement. He went on to say that the LGBTQ community has, quote, taken refuge behind the document's concepts, and that withdrawing from the treaty would not increase domestic violence. That position has some support. Earlier this year, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said that the way to stop violence against women is by strengthening the institution of the family.
If there is violence in the family, what kind of family is it?
Melek Gonder is the spokesperson of a group known as the We Will Stop Femicide Platform. It's a Turkish nonprofit that counts murders and suspicious deaths of women across the country. This year, it's tallied more than 200 of them. They include 27-year-old Pinar Gültekin, a university student whose ex-boyfriend confessed to killing her when she refused to get back together with him. In the 10 days after her murder, Melek Gonder says, her group counted 11 additional deaths. She says the killers were emboldened by the national discourse, leaders casually discussing the removal of protections for women.
I think the only a small group of men, conservative men, demanding this.
Some women are taking to social media to protest, posting black and white portraits of themselves in an echo of one of the last photos taken of Pinar Gültekin. Others are taking to the streets. In this video, posted by Onder's organization, protesters last month called on the Turkish president to stay in the Istanbul Convention. But activists say they're not confident he's listening. Erdogan draws a lot of support from right-wing nationalists and religious conservatives. Over the weekend, Turkish Muslims celebrated Kurban Bayram, the festival of the sacrifice. As relatives streamed into her home, Kubra Shamalolu ducked into the garden for a quick smoke and a video call with me, adjusting her long black headscarf.
When you ask people, you know, they're not against equality. When you say equality is like there is gender equality in Quran, they do not say anything against it. They say, yeah, this is the beauty of Quran, but...
Shamalolu is part of the Havle Women's Organization, which calls itself Turkey's first feminist Muslim women's group.
We know what we are talking about. We have been practicing observing Muslim women all our lives.
When it comes to the Istanbul Convention, she also thinks Turkey should stay. Shamalolu says that a lot of the opposition comes from not actually understanding what the treaty entails. Besides, she says, religious rules need to keep up with the modern world.
Even though it was true historically, it doesn't matter. It cannot be happening right now. Me saying this doesn't taint my religion. In fact, I think it supports my religion.
As Turkey awaits a decision from the ruling party, women's groups say they're planning to gather tomorrow in protest. For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin, Istanbul.
The stories you hear on The World don't just stop when a reporter signs off on the radio. The show continues online, where you can connect with the journalists who bring the stories to you. Join the conversation on Twitter, at The World, or hit me up. I'm at Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Trying times make for great art, right? That thought must have been on the minds of many artists at the beginning of the pandemic, trying to find the silver lining to this very gray cloud, thinking perhaps now's my opportunity to finally create a true masterpiece. Things don't always work out that way, of course. Physical distancing, for example, a lot more challenging than many of us probably expected. The French-Chilean singer Ana Tijoux has managed to draw inspiration from one aspect of these trying times. The World's Jorge Valencia brings us the story behind her new single, Paquet.
The singer Ana Tijoux tries to maintain a balance in her life. She works hard and takes time to relax when she can.
Today I'm going to the beach and chill out with my kid.
Tijoux was visiting Barcelona when we spoke. She has two kids, a son and a daughter, who make themselves heard occasionally.
Yes, she's jumping as a crazy girl right now.
And parenting, of course, is only one of her jobs.
I'm a musician, composer, rapper, mother.
The Grammy-nominated artist is now working on her fifth album. In the midst of a pandemic, she says she's reminded that the work of a composer is collaborative.
Even if you are a solo artist, you always compose with your friends, your friend that is a pianist or a guitarist. It's a social network. It's not a solo network.
Her new single is titled Paquet, which loosely translates to So Why? She was first inspired by a phrase that was popularized a few years ago on social media. Two men carry an apparently intoxicated friend out of a party. You already know how I get, the friend says, so why do you invite me?
I mean, like, that was like an inspiration, of course, yes. The first idea, but then it's moved automatically with everything that happened in the world, yes.
Everything that happened in the world, of course, is the pandemic. In the chorus of Paquet, Tijoux sings, you already know how I get, so why do you invite me? But she's referring to being an artist who's going to sing about politics. Tijoux starts her first verse with a reference to Chile's former health minister, Jaime Mañalich. Back in March, he explained in a TV interview that the coronavirus could mutate.
¿Qué pasa si el virus muta y se pone, perdón que use una palabra, buena persona?
What if the virus mutates and turns into a good guy, Mañalich asked in a televised interview that immediately went viral.
It was crazy, like, don't worry, the virus can be a good person.
Mañalich has since lost his job. Ana Tijoux says she was also inspired by British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who in March seemed to take the coronavirus lightly.
I was at a hospital the other night where I think there were actually a few coronavirus patients, and I shook hands with everybody, you'll be pleased to know, and I continue to shake hands.
Johnson got sick, received intensive care, and recovered a few weeks later.
Then Jair Bolsonaro saying, like, I was an athletic person, so do you remember that?
Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro also in March said that because he had a background as an athlete, he wouldn't feel anything if he got sick. He eventually did contract the virus, but didn't become any less dismissive about it. We lament all deaths, Bolsonaro said at one point, but we are all going to die anyway. In Brazil, at least 94,000 people have died from COVID-19. Tiju says this is what she drew from in her track, Paque.
I think it's surrealistic. They don't care about the people that is sick or the people that passed away. They don't even have empathy. And that's make me very worried at the same time, when people doesn't have an emotion about life.
The same way this is Tiju's first time rhyming about public health, it is also her first rhyming over cumbia. Cumbia is a genre with Afro-Indigenous roots that is massively popular across Latin America.
Do you have like a particular cumbia song that you just really love that was an inspiration for you?
Yes.
Tiju says there are actually many cumbia artists who inspire her. The most famous is Toto La Momposina from Colombia. And in the middle of Tiju's song, Paque, she switches to another genre pioneered by Afro-Latinx musicians. It's called Merengue House. And one of her favorite groups is Sandy y Papo from the Dominican Republic. Tiju says her playfulness, humor, and seriousness are connected. She says musicians have opinions, and this one is hers.
We're not here to be pleasant. We're here to be honest with what we think. If you like or not, that is another question. And if it's good or bad, at least it's honest, I think.
We have the video for Paque on our website, theworld.org. There are space cats. Yes, cats in space. And as Ana Tiju would probably say, now you know how she gets, so why don't you check it out? For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia. Sabías que la corona puede ser buena persona. Ministro, perdone la palabra, pero incomoda. Cambia de actitud, como Talibú. De todo el planeta somos el mejor sistema de salud. Que este virus muta, si Dios quiere se permuta. Que los molnis se inmuta, pero en la calle se multa. Si vende hasta la fruta, que soplan a la curva. Cuidado con la que viene la yuca.
Great new sounds from Ana Tiju there. As we heard from Jorge, she's no stranger to speaking her mind. Here's one more taste, a healthy taste of that from her upcoming album. This is called Antifa Dance. Somos los patis pelados, los comas, los rotos, los chulos y quemados. Somos los cholos morenos, los chicos sin pelo en la lengua y ya está. Somos morenos y qué bueno, no tenemos miedo, no tenemos nada, nada, nada. A mí que tu izquierda siempre fue derecha, me da la sospecha que tú te aprovechas. Tú nada cosechas ni prende la mecha, y ahí cuando fuera no te prendo vela. Baja y escucha, escucha la lucha de estar seinao, tremenda trucha. Ya no hay excusa para ser blanducha, no se me confunda, buena capucha. Papá, ¿cómo está? No necesito estar high. Ana Tiju sings, a few years ago, it was unthinkable to reassess the word fascism. Perhaps, then again, look around the globe and the rise of strongman leaders on almost every continent, and you can see why reassessing them through a different prism is in order for artists like Ana Tiju, for entire protest movements. El amigo de todo, no amigo de nadie. Cántalo suave, noche de plaza. ¿Cómo se hace la clave y el pase la llave para que todo esto se acabe? Todo se cae, todo se sabe. Ir a Haití, Chile combate. A liberar este mundo completo si tocan a uno. ¡Toquen el pueblo! Ana Tiju there trying to get you to dance and to think while you do it. Antifa Dance takes us out today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.